Hi, and welcome to the Passion Podcast. It's Louis Giglio coming to you from the Passion House in rainy Alpharetta, Georgia, which is becoming a common theme. But hey, rain or shine, we are going to be at Verizon Amphitheater at Encore Park on Good Friday night. And just want to make sure, as I say hello, that you guys are reminded about that. We've got a lot of people showing up right now, but we still got room for a whole lot more. So if you're interested, check out goodfriday@verizon.com. And we're excited about the night. I mean, it is the Hello Love tour stop in Atlanta, so Chris and Israel will be there. But it's really not just another stamped version of the Hello Love tour, which is phenomenal. It's really a celebration of the cross of Jesus Christ, and it's going to be an incredible night. So just want to make sure you know about that before we get going. It's awesome to have you back with us. I hope you enjoyed the first installment of our interview with Reverend Stanley. And incredible little jump off there, kind of flashback to the past for me, but we're looking forward to the rest of that interview a little bit later in our podcast today. You're going to really love some of the edifying things that you hear as we come down to the end of our interview time today and start talking about the real life of a couple of crazy high school and college guys who didn't have a brain at the time, but God was going to use us anyway. It was really exciting. But before we get to that, I want to let you know about a couple of things. One, Passion 2010 is getting close. When I say close in conference planning terms, it actually is getting really close. I think it's about 9 months away, which is very close. The price goes up tomorrow, so most of you will have missed that by the time you hear this podcast. But April 1st, the price bumps up, and I just want to say we're excited. It's not so much about, you know, numbers and dollars, but it's great to see people this far out, university students particularly, come to a website, say, I want to be a part of this, and it's March, and I'm like, who signs up for anything in March? But it's been exciting, and the price goes up at midnight tomorrow night. And so we're hoping for a big push between now and midnight on April 1st night. That always is a little bit confusing. When we say on April 1st, people are like, does that mean like when it crosses over from 12 o'clock to, 12:01 a.m.? Or when is that? And the actual registration increase is at the end of the day on Wednesday. So midnight, Wednesday night, 12 o'clock p.m. That's a.m., when it hits 12 o'clock a.m., see why people are confused. I can understand that. When it hits 12 a.m. on Wednesday night, so you've already come home, you've studied, you've hung out with your friends, and now it's close to midnight. It's like 11:20. That's a good time to start registering right then because you got 40 minutes to go. And as a college student, it's like dog years. 40 minutes equates to 6 weeks. And so that's when you want to start, 11:20 on Wednesday night, and they'll give you 40 minutes to figure it out, get online, get in there, register. You save $20 when you do that, and that's exciting. Did I miss something, Jonathan? You gave me that look like you're going to have to edit something out a little bit later. Now we got a conversation, we got consultation going on between my producer and assistant producer. And we're good? Okay, we're all good. So Passion 2010, by the way, running total, we started the podcast with 3,611 people have already staked a claim for a seat or staked a place at Passion 2010. We're up to 3,617, so we'll see what happens while we're going here. The 10th person back was a group of 10 from Cold Spring Harbor, New York. Was exciting. The 9th registration back from South Carolina, so now we're getting back down to the deep south. Went from New York, though. I got to let you know, we start out New York, came back to South Carolina. Number 8 was Tennessee. Number 7 came in from Kansas. Number 6 from Indiana. Number 5 from Alabama. Number 4 from North Carolina. Number 3 that just came in is Joseph from Jacksonville, Florida, registering 20 people, so that's very cool and exciting. Second person just back was Gordon B., a leader from Hendersonville, Tennessee, and the number one person who just last registered for Passion 2010, as fate would have it, is an Auburn person. Brooke, we're proud of you, representing War Eagle from Pike Road, Alabama. And that sounds like a weird place to live, especially if you lived on Pike Road in Pike Road. That would be really weird. I live on 3728 Pike Road in Pike Road. You know, that would be kind of weird. So I don't know if there's a Pike Road in Pike Road, but I think Pike Road's actually a city. We'll Google that and come up with that. Our crack team here will be on that in a heartbeat, and we'll give you guys the details. But Brooke, welcome to Passion 2010. And we are excited about what God's going to do. Equally excited about 1 Million Can, and just want to update you guys on what's going on. Passion City Church last Sunday at the Forum, which was an incredible night, by the way. I loved it. I love doing church once a month because the excitement builds and people are really like into it. You know, it's not that that doesn't happen every week, but people have been waiting over a month in this case to get back to worship corporately, and it was really cool seeing just thousands of people pack into this place. And one of our focus with our foci with Love Atlanta, Love the World was the Sorry Bari Project, and we were looking at a way locally to help women and young girls trapped in prostitution, and to help with these precious women in Calcutta, India. And we were able to give $10,000 from the generosity of people that night towards our 1 million can goal of $100,000 for the Sorry Bari Project. And that's just exciting. The number for Sorry Bari is up to $81,008. So we only have a little bit to go there to max out our goal. And then Hope and Homes, which Chris has been talking about every night on tour, is up to $132,022. So I don't know what that response you get or you want to give for that. I don't know if you're in your car or on your way to work or if you're riding a bike across campus. But I said $132,000 for Hope and Homes and $81,000 for Sorry Bari. That's $200,000 for those two causes. And they're both getting really close to being maxed out. And I think it's something we could do together. We've been doing extensive research, and we've crossed over 300 podcast listeners worldwide. That's international. And in some of the international countries, we can't track exactly. So we think it's give or take, it could be 300 or 307 people. And just think about it. It's April, starting at tomorrow. And if each one of us listeners, counting me and our producer and assistant producer, or assistant to the producer, if each one of us, and if Gladys also, so if all of us plus Gladys gave $10 in the month of April, and there's 300 of us, that's $3,000. That's and every who can't do $10 over the course of the month of April. And so if you're listening and you're like, Louie, you keep talking about 1 million can, all I hear is 1 million can, 1 million can. Well, there's a reason for that, and that's it's a cause that we believe in, and we're going to keep believing in for a long time. And it requires all of us only this, to do something small, to be a part of something great. And if all of us, over the course of a month, gave $10 to 1 million can, we could together give $3,000, which could provide 3 life-altering surgeries for kids in underdeveloped parts of the world. It could almost build a well for a village, for the life of that village. It could make a massive difference. It could, you know, just you go look on those causes and divide it by, or, you know, factor in $3,000. It could do a lot. And that's just for 1 month, just our podcast listeners, nobody else out there, just 300 of us banding together. So I just want to keep it on the radar. I want to keep thanking you for your generosity. And it's just been amazing. We were up in Minneapolis with Chris on the Hello Love Tour Sunday night. And the night before, I think they were in Chicago, a little kid had brought in this jar that he made. This little, it kind of looked like a to-go cup with a plastic lid on top of it that he'd cut a hole in. And he went online and printed out 1 million cans somehow, and he pasted it around the cup and made his own little 1 million can thing. It was really cool. And he'd been putting his change in there for like a month or so, and he brought it up to the 1 million can table in Chicago at the concert and gave it to Tyler, and there was $100 in this cup that this kid had brought. And he just was like, man, I get it. I want to make a difference. I want to do something. And I'm just like, that is the whole point of the whole thing. And seeing Chris share the story again in Minneapolis was incredible, and people are grabbing onto it. So thank you, and continue to lean into that with us. Before we get to the interview, I just wanted to say, too, Shelley and I were in Minneapolis. We weren't really planning to go up to Minneapolis. We try not to travel up to Minneapolis between October and June when there's snow on the ground and temperatures are usually down in the sub-zero range. Sure enough, flying up there Sunday, a lot of snow between here and Minneapolis still. But I'm only kidding, Minneapolis. We love it. We love the cold weather, love the sub-zero temperatures. It's fantastic, and have great friends. But we went to Minneapolis to just connect up with Chris and his band, and then to fly down late with them to Tyler on Sunday night, which we did after the concert was over that night to be a part of the funeral service for Chris's grandfather, Lionel Duncan, which was yesterday on Monday in a little town called Malakoff, Texas. And then he was buried outside of there in another smaller town called, I think it's called Cayuga, Texas. Hopefully I got that right. But I just wanted to honor him in a way before we get into the interview with Andy today, because I met Chris a long time ago. And from the first few days I ever met him, he started talking about his grandfather. He called him Papaw. And he'd always talk about his Papaw and how what an influence he'd been on his life. I mean, this guy lived a phenomenal life. He was 84 when he went to heaven last Thursday at 4 p.m. But he was a principal of a high school. He was a superintendent of a school district, coached basketball at Cayuga High School, led him to the state basketball championship in Texas in 1954. And I mean, that's kind of wild to think, but Chris would tell all these stories. Like, he was so into high school basketball, and every year he would go with Chris and his brothers to the high school basketball tournament in Austin every single year. And they'd go, and he'd come down in his RV with Chris's grandmother, and they'd watch all the games. And Chris told me about where he lived on this lake outside of Malakoff and how he fried fish. And I mean, when you talk about frying fish, you're up at the top of my list. I mean, there's only a few things on earth better than fried fish, and especially when you catch it in the morning and fry it, you know, that afternoon, is pretty special. And I never got to meet his granddad, but he just talked on and on and on about him. And then just over the past few months, his granddad, his cancer really accelerated, and it kind of became apparent that things were, you know, more than likely it was going to be the end of his time on earth pretty soon. And fortunately, his grandfather was able to come up to Nashville last fall for the celebration we had when Chris got his platinum record for arriving and his gold record for See the Morning. And Chris's mom and dad were there, his brothers and his sister-in-laws and his little nephews and his niece were there. And his granddad got to come. His grandmom couldn't come because she has Alzheimer's and isn't able to travel. But his granddad got to come, and I was so excited because for 2 days we were up in Nashville, and I got to be around Mr. Duncan and got to see what Chris had talked about all these years. And he really was a special man. You could tell it just as soon as you saw him. And I think probably one of the rocks of Chris's life and the person Chris probably looked up to the most on earth. And so we wanted to be a part of that. So we flew down late Sunday night. All the days are run together now. We got into Tyler, I don't know what time it was, 1:30 in the morning on Sunday night. And we're able to go out to Malakoff, First Baptist Malakoff, Texas, where Mr. Duncan went to church and where he worshiped. He was a deacon there and taught Sunday school. Loved the pastor, which was pretty cool. And he told the pastor, "I want to make sure you do my funeral." They'd just gotten a brand new pastor at the church. If you can imagine this, some of you are living out in, you know, suburban areas and inner city urban areas, and you're not relating to what I'm talking about here. If you've never been to Trinity, Texas, or, you know, somewhere like that, you don't understand what I'm talking about. But this young guy goes out to be the pastor, and he's 28 years old right now. And he's been there, I think, 2 or 3 years, or a year and a half, or something like that. Nathan, I can't remember how long you've been there, sorry. But so he went there when he was like 26 or 7 to be the pastor of this very, I would guess, the average age would be up there a little bit. And just huge vision for God, serving God. And Mr. Duncan told him, "When I die, I want you to preach my funeral." And I just, how cool is that for an 84-year-old guy to tell a 28-year-old guy, "I want to make sure you're the one that speaks at my funeral." He loved this guy and the way that he opened the Word of God. And I was kidding around with Nathan yesterday at the church. I'd met Nathan once before back when he was a college student, and I was speaking at an event that he was at. But I said, "Man, that's pretty cool coming to a place like First Baptist Malakoff, and you have vision, you want to bring change, and a lot of that has to do with music and worship style. And so you're singing one of these new songs one Sunday, and one of the members comes up and says, 'I don't like those new songs we're singing. I don't like that. You know, where'd that song come from?'" And to be able to say back to him, "Well, Actually, it so happens that Lionel Duncan's grandson wrote that song. So if you don't like the song we sung this morning, you can go right over there and take it up with Mr. Duncan. I'm sure he'd be happy to talk to you about it. And I'm thinking if you're a 28-year-old pastor and you got Chris Tomlin's grandfather at your church, that's a step forward in the process of bringing a church into a new era of worship and around some of these new songs. But all that to say, the service yesterday was incredible. And I think if you don't know this, it becomes truer and truer the more you're around memorial services and funerals. But, you know, you preach your own funeral. It doesn't matter whether the guy's 28, 38, 68, 78, whether he's unknown, just out of seminary, or somebody that's a famous author, speaker. It doesn't matter who speaks at your funeral. You preach your own funeral. And your funeral will not be better than your life. And if your life is great, your funeral will be great. I don't care if it's 9 people gathered around a hole in the ground, your funeral will be great. Because that moment crystallizes your life. And you can't, I've stood on the other side of that casket in a lot of funerals, and you can't make stuff up in that moment. What comes out is what is. And to see Chris and his 2 brothers, Ryan and Corey, share at Mr. Duncan's service yesterday, and to hear them talk about the man that taught them how to be a man, how to be a husband, how to live life, how to walk with integrity, how to work hard, how to appreciate things, how to laugh, how to enjoy a good story, how to fry fish, and all the things that every son wants most in life. And you know, no son wants anything more, and no grandson wants anything more than a man they can look up to, and that they can say, and Chris said it yesterday, he said, if I could have half the integrity, half the character, half the dedication, half the humility that my papa had, then I will live more than a full life. And you can make that up. Either that's true or it's not true. And it was a great celebration. He lived an incredible life, left an amazing legacy. You saw it in the faces of his grandsons, one who's a firefighter, one who's a high school basketball coach following in the steps of Lionel, one who's a songwriter and a worship leader at a church in Atlanta that already has too many churches, but we planted one more anyway. And there you saw the legacy and the hope and the future. And Chris and I wrote a song a few months back. I say wrote it loosely. I'll tell you that whole story someday. But we'd been through a lot, and Ashley's loss, some other things that we'd been carrying in our hearts, and we just wanted to be able to give something back to people who were looking down at that hole that they cut in the earth where they put our body when we die. And we wanted to give something to people that they could sing in that moment, and something in that moment that would lift up the hope that's in all of us and be able to express that back to God. And we started working on this song together, and we had some early lyrics that all kind of got punted. Most of my early lyrics got punted in the process, and that's always a good thing when you're writing a song with Chris Tomlin. All you got to do is get him started, and the rest will be fantastic. And so we worked on a couple of versions. I remember sitting in my living room over here at our house one night working through some stuff and singing through some things and working on a chorus idea. And then, as Chris often will, he went away. And once he got home and got in his own world, he came back with just this brilliant song. And one of the phrases that survived, or the phrase that survived from those early days and from our first thoughts about it, I remember somewhere we were on the How Great Is Our God tour, walking back from lunch across the street to where the bus was parked, and we were having this conversation about this song. And this phrase we were both so excited about, and the grave is overwhelmed. And that just felt like everything we wanted to say. And that song has landed in a lot of people's hearts. We get emails almost every week, if not several times a week, about families that the song is landing in their grief and giving them hope. But you never realize sometimes when God gives you things like that, that he's given you something not just for those people, but he's giving it to you. And so after Chris shared yesterday, he was going to sing I Will Rise. His papa asked him, I want you to sing I Will Rise at my funeral. And Chris was like, man, there's no way I can do that. And I said, oh, yeah, there is. There totally is. And when he got through speaking, he was supposed to sing it before the pastor came, and he just couldn't. And he just looked at the pastor and said, you need to come. And after the pastor spoke, Chris got up and sang I Will Rise which was true of his papaw, 4 o'clock on Thursday. I will rise when he calls my name. No more sorrow, no more shame. And that happened for him, and it was a beautiful moment for us to be in that place together. And so I just wanted to say a shout-out to my friend Chris Tomlin, and in a way of just honoring a great man, Lionel Duncan, who lived a phenomenal life and is now with Jesus, home free. And for you and I that are on this side, and for those of you who you and I who have quite a few more trips to the cemetery to go in our lifetime, this is true, and it is what gives us hope today and forever. So this is I Will Rise, and on the back side of this, we'll rejoin Pastor Stanley and new rookie Pastor Giglio for the second part of our interview together.
There's a day that's drawing near, when this darkness breaks to light and the shadows disappear, and my faith shall be my eyes. Jesus has overcome, and the grave is overwhelmed.
So you mentioned in our last episode that you were not a good advisor in terms of church planning, because you said when we planted the church, you know, it started off, there was a lot of people, there was a lot of momentum, and so I'm not the right person to ask. But you did say through planning churches, you've learned a lot as well. But I want to ask you to go back to planning North Point and lead into those first weeks and meeting that very first time, and then kind of what happened. Is there anything that you would say to someone like me who's a rookie pastor, or someone listening to this that's just coming into the church planning world? Man, I'm really glad we did that. You know, we weren't even smart enough to know how smart that was, but God was so kind to us in showing us that, and that's the one thing that I'm so glad we did, or the two things I'm so glad we did. And on the flip side of that, is there anything that you're like, man, we learned a really fast lesson on that one, and if I had it to do over again, there's not anything that I really regret, but here's one thing I definitely wouldn't do again.
I think the most important thing, humanly speaking, for church planners is vision, because that's really all you have. It's just a church, it's just an idea. And because as soon as you say church, something comes to everyone's mind, even people who don't go to church, as soon as you say church, everybody defines that. And so as you have already begun experiencing, Louis, your mental picture of what could and should be in this thing you're creating is so important, and everybody's going to try to chip away at that, redefine it, add to it, distract from it, and it has to be so crystal clear. And one of the things that I challenge our guys on, and every time I talk to church planners, is what is it? What is it you're trying to do? I mean, if you can't say it to me clearly, you know, Howard Hendricks had a saying, you know, if it's a mist in the pulpit, it's a fog in the pew. You know,
right.
If it's not clear when I say it, it's going to be a whole lot less clear when people start repeating it. So that mental picture of what could and should be that God has called you to, it is the most important thing. Otherwise, by the time you arrive, or by the time you're 3 or 4 years into this, you know, church planters might look around and go, I don't like this church. I'm responsible for it. I created it, you know, by God's grace, but I don't like, I know a church planter who quit his own church 2 years in.
He said
to me over lunch, a very talented speaker, I said, why are you leaving? He said, I don't like the direction the church is going in. I said, you're the pastor. You started it. He didn't like the direction it was going in. But what happened was he gave away the vision a little too quick. He had people around him. There wasn't alignment. And instead of waiting until there was absolute alignment with, you know, the influencers, he started giving it away too early. And so vision is such it's overused, granted, but it's such a fragile, fragile thing. And to have a statement or an idea or a word or a, you know, something that you can come back to over and over and over saying, this is what we're doing, it becomes the grid or the filter through which all decisions are made. And if that's not clear early on, or if it gets lost early on, things go bad quickly. And again, a person may end up with a church that's successful financially or even successful in terms of critical mass. But, you know, they go home on the weekend and go, this isn't exactly what I was trying to accomplish. And that happens so quickly, again, because everybody who shows up already has in their mind what they think this is going to be.
Right.
And in your case, with the uniqueness of Passion City Church, as we've talked before, you know, this may be as or more important in your situation than others, because on one hand, you've got instant critical mass, but every single one of those people has an idea of what this is going to become, what you really mean. You know, in the early days at North Point, we said up front, we're not ever going to have adult Sunday school. We're going to have community groups that meet in homes. And for 2.5 years, people would say, now, when we get a building, we're going to have Sunday school, right? I said, no. We don't not have Sunday school because we don't have a building. We don't not have Sunday school because we're not going to ever have it. And I, as many times as I said that, you would think, but finally we had the final leadership meeting where I said, okay, we're not going to talk about this anymore. Here's the vision. Here's how we're going to do it. And, you know, but those kinds of things, and good things. I mean, adult Sunday school is a good thing. We just chose not to do it. So, you know, in your situation, every church planner situation, there's this, you know, God has put something in your heart, in your mind, and it's a unique angle, it's a unique twist, it's a style, it's all those things. And I mean, people will chip away, rob it, add to it. And good people,
yeah.
You know, well-meaning people, people who love Jesus, you know, but they've all got an idea.
You guys, this kind of summertime when you knew you were going to plant a church.
It was... Oh yeah, I don't know if you want me. We don't.
And I don't want to get into that.
To go
no,
back
I'm just
into
trying
that.
To do. I'm trying to do a little timeline. It's about summertime-ish, or was it summer or
it was, August?
Late summer. When the first
late
time,
August. Yeah.
Late August, and the first time North Point met was October.
We had an organizational meeting in October. Yeah.
And the first meeting was
the first actual service was November.
November.
See, and then we had one in December.
3 months basically before you opened the doors, and how far along was the vision developed in those 3 months?
Well,
and when did it come to the point that you were like, okay, I feel good, I can set the vision down now, it's clear?
Well, the difference was for us is that, as you mentioned in our last podcast, 2 years previous to that, my dad had asked me to go out to a warehouse area on the perimeter of Atlanta and start having services. So really the vision for what I wanted to do with my life and how I viewed the local church, you know, in ministry, you sort of have that in the back of your mind anyway. The way we say it is, well, if I'm ever in charge,
yeah,
or one day, or if it was up to me, you know, every student pastor has that thought, if it was up to me, okay? So I'd had 10 years of if it was up to me, okay? Then we go out there and we start this campus as part of First Baptist Atlanta. And so for 2 years, we'd had an experience, and for 2 years, it had shaped the way, you know, what I wanted to do the rest of my life in terms of ministry. So when we started North Point, even though there was a 3-month on-ramp, there was 2 years of experience with a team that shaped what we wanted to do. So reality is North Point really started in terms of ideas and conceptually 2 years before we actually started. So that it wasn't as quick as it may look if somebody just looks at the launch date. So
yeah.
I don't know if that answers
so
your question.
So at what point along the way did you feel like the vision was clear? I mean, it's clear in your mind, and clear enough in your mind that you knew it was going to be clear in the important people's minds in terms of those who were going to carry this vision?
In the early days of the warehouse experience, when I was working for my dad, I had a friend named Bob, who's still a dear friend, who was an unchurched guy, very secular, even to this day, even though he's a committed Christian, he would still consider himself a very secular person. Bob came to church, and I knew he was coming, and I remember what I was preaching on, and I was talking about taking baby steps. And we had this very raw environment. It was too cold, concrete floor, speakers on scaffolding, very, very raw. And the first Sunday I preached there, I told Sandra, I said, this is what I want to do the rest of my life. I want to be in an environment that the environment itself takes away the resistance to the gospel. Mm. And about 3 weeks later is when Bob rolled in for the first time, sat in the back. And after that, we had a conversation. He came to Christ. And I think the experience of the environment and seeing how just the environment itself stripped away resistance for Bob, I thought, this is what I want to do. Now, we had seen that in student ministry for, 10 years, and adults would come to student ministry events and say, I wish big church was like this. And so I thought, well, let's just make big church like that. Why do they like it? Because it removed some of the unnecessary obstacles that sometimes traditional or, church can create. So I just fell in love with creating environments that unchurched people would find attractive. And so our vision statement became, we want to create churches that unchurched people love to attend. And that was the litmus test for everything in those early days. And so when church people would be upset, it didn't bother me. I really didn't want to create a church for them anyway. Mm-hmm. But the church people who were attracted were church people who had unchurched friends, and they had no place to take them.
No place to bring them.
And, the purist says, well, shouldn't evangelism happen in those relationships and they bring them to church? I'm like, yeah, that's the model I grew up in. It doesn't work. Why not partner with people and create environments where you bring your unchurched friend to begin a conversation? So that was the thing we wanted to do, and it's pretty much driven everything we've done ever since.
I was at a church a couple of years ago that started out a youth ministry. They had that same kind of mentality mm-hmm. of, the youth ministry is really moving, and so they started a church out of that. And that was quite a while ago, and now you don't really get that feeling there. Hmm. You don't feel that sense of, man, we're starting, why can't big church be like youth church? It's like now the youth are saying, why can't big church be like youth church? But the big church was the youth church. And so looking downstream with North Point, how do you manage that over the long haul when you started out of this idea? And now you are the idea,
right?
And you've become...
We are the tradition.
...this establishment, and you got a long ways to go in your journey, I would assume, of leading this church.
I hope.
And so how do you manage that process so that
That's
you still are...
That's a constant conversation.
Where you were.
Constant conversation. And there's several things. One is you have to pay attention to student culture, and which is easy for me because I have three teenagers. Because student culture is that very culture that's one day going to be college and adult culture. So you have to pay attention to culture. And one of the great things about multi-campus is it allows us to do some things on one campus as an experiment before we export it to other campuses, and it allows us to be more demographic specific. And our three demographics are very different. You attend Buckhead, Alpharetta, and Cumming, and when we have church people come in, church leaders come in, we ask them to do all three, and they always come back and say, wow, those are very different groups of people, and they are. So all church planters have to be sensitive to the demographic they're in. But in terms of not allowing things to get stale, that's a commitment to music. Music's a huge part of it because music sets the tone and I think defines a church. When people walk in, the music's going to tell you everything. So to stay current, to stay in somewhat the center of pop culture, it is a constant conversation. And we don't get it right all the time, but I guarantee you that is a part of conversation all the time. And the churches that refuse to have those conversations will just find something they're comfortable with and stay there forever. And we've talked about this. As I get older, churches mature and age with their pastor and demographics and neighborhoods age. Again, having multi-campus and forcing us to be relevant to more than one kind of demographic at a time, I think it's helped our whole organization stay more flexible than maybe it would have otherwise.
Yeah, that's cool. So you Is there anything for, I mean, what's transferable in this process? You know, I know there is a model of North Point, and you're not afraid to share that either. I mean, you're not afraid to say, hey, we feel like this model works.
Yep.
If you think it works for you, here's resources to help you
go copy
make this model work. But what if somebody doesn't necessarily, they're not looking for a model, they're looking for principles. Mm-hmm. What are the transferable things from your journey into North Point and these other strategic partners you mentioned that you could say to somebody like me to say, here's a couple of things that probably are going to be just as true for you as they were for us?
There's a lot.
Besides vision, and vision was a big, huge one.
Yeah. There is, you know, there's several, you know, church becomes, any organization becomes complex over time. So trying to keep things simple is huge, and growth creates complexity, which eats away at simplicity. So that's like a dashboard thing you have to always look at, because things become more complex with time. And so, you know, if you were to look at the 5 meetings I had, you know, 2 days ago, you would say, now, which one of these meetings has anything to do with creating church and church people love to attend? And I would say, none of them. But look how my time's getting eaten up with things that are, you know, you could argue are not vision critical or mission critical. So there's that whole complexity thing that a church planner or a pastor has to keep his eye on or her eye on, because we get pulled into the urgent, and vision is never urgent. It is never, ever urgent. In fact, if we never reached another unchurched person in our 3 campuses, we would still appear to be very successful. We'd have plenty of money. In fact, we'd have more money because we'd have less visitors that eat up our resources and don't give anything. You know, at some point, the fewer people that show up, the more money you have. Honestly, if you're...
So you
if
can
you're
get real, the right people to show
exactly.
up, then you don't really... You're golden.
Your per-person giving goes up as the people who aren't giving go away. So you could even argue that our financial model would be stronger if we quit reaching people. So all that complexity becomes very, very distracting over time. Then on the practical side, people need community. And people need connecting points. And regardless of the model that a church planner or a church adopts, you have to ask the question, where are the connecting points? And the way we say it is this: we want to create easy, obvious, strategic steps to community. They have to be easy, that person can actually take that step. They have to be obvious, they have to know what they are, and they have to be strategic. We're not just going to add programming to have programming. Each program needs to be a step toward community. So when people come to us with ministry ideas, good ministry ideas, ideas that have impacted their kids or, you know, that have worked in other communities, and they say, hey, this worked, would you do this? Would you be open to this program? We say, is it an easy, obvious, strategic step to community? If yes, we'll consider it. If no, we just won't do it. So, you know, creating a culture around, again, that kind of specificity, again, that's vision-driven, all those are transferable principles. It may not look like ours, but every church has to have connecting points. Every church has to help people create a sense of community. We believe that real spiritual growth always happens within the context of relationships. So anything a church can do to enhance relationships, you're going to help people grow. If it's just a show, you know, that's not enough. If it's just, you know, my 3 friends meeting and we never mix it up or add anybody, you know, that's not going to work either. So, you know, there has to be both the attractional part and the who are you doing life with part. So again, it may look 100 different ways, but that's going to happen. The other thing that drives us, we have come down on the fact that we think basically God works and grows people in 5 ways. There are 5 things. So once we discover these 5 things, we have tried to build all of our programming to those 5 things. And so when we talk to church planners, we say, you know what? Don't adopt our model, but here are the ways God grows people's faith. He grows their faith through relationships, through practical Bible teaching, through personal ministry, through private disciplines, and through unexpected events. You tell your story, and your story is going to revolve around the first time you heard practical Bible teaching, somebody taught you how to have a quiet time, the first time you served, there was this guy in my life, there was this girl in my life, I joined a group, and then we got divorced, then we had our first child, then we moved. When you hear people tell their stories, those 5 things always surface. So we say, you know what? Build any model you want, but build it to these 5 things, and people will grow spiritually. You and I grew up in a model that was just practical Bible teaching on Sunday, practical Bible teaching Sunday night, practical Bible teaching on Wednesday, go to youth camp for some more practical Bible teaching. And then we went on a mission trip every once in a while. So it took one of those five and just, you know, piled on. So we've tried to back up and say, can we create a rhythm in our organization around these five things? And if so, people will grow. And that's very transferable.
Yeah. So it sounds like as you're talking that one of the necessary components is strong leadership. And I feel like a lot of people in church world resist that because church is supposed to be this family and it's supposed to be this sort of organic thing and everybody's a part of it. And we've all seen the bad side of strong leadership, but I think we've also all seen the bad side of no leadership. And talk about that a little bit because you're talking clarity here. You're talking vision. You're talking direction. Everybody knows where the organization's going, and I think everybody knows who's kind of at the helm. And under God, that's you. And a lot of people will say, well, you know what, I don't think the pastor needs to say, you know, this and that and the other. I think all of us need to kind of have a vote in what's going on.
Yep.
How do you speak to that? And I know personally about you that you're a strong leader, but I also know that you're not one of these guys that when you walk in a room, everybody's got to stand up and do the right thing and say the right thing. And, you know, you're very, here I am, I'm Andy, I'm on the team, but you're also leading the team.
The short answer is follow we never, ever works. There's no example in history that I know of follow we working organizationally in church or any other place. Point leadership is a principle that I think was established by God that, as you said, can be abused, and we have all seen it abused, but you can't abandon point leadership, and go all the way back to Moses, Abraham, Joshua, Jesus, Paul, Peter. I mean, there's always a somebody who's blazing a trail, and your ministry is a great example of that. The question isn't should there be a point leader. The question is how do you lead as a point leader in a way that honors God and honors the people around you? And Jesus answered that question. He said, don't be like the Gentiles who lord it over the people who have to follow them. He said, but put yourself last. You can be a point leader and constantly say to the people around you, how can I help? How can I help? How can I help? That's what great leaders do. They say, how can I help? I'm in charge, but how can I help? And in a culture where there's strong point leadership, but where there's an understanding of mutual submission, you have a great organizational culture. If you extract mutual submission and it's, you know, since I'm the leader, it's all top down, you know, that's just a dictator and nobody wants to work in that environment. But to your point, if you say, well, since point leadership is so easily abused, let's not have any, then you basically just have randomness and chaos, and it's just very, very difficult to get things done. So, and we have, as you know, there is a movement in the local church that's away from point leadership, and there are people who don't want to hear Christians talk about leadership or leadership principles, and that's secular, and you're trying to be like the world, and on and on and on. And I think, well, that's fine. You're just not going to get much done. And so there has to be point leadership, but there has to be mutual submission, and you blend those two, and you have a powerful cultural dynamic.
You know, speaking of powerful cultural dynamics, I just want to take people back because we're right in the middle of some good stuff. People are taking notes right now, and I'm giving them a chance just to process and finish those little scribbles they're doing. We didn't just start out, you know, where we are. And I just keep, I
no,
think it's important
didn't.
To say this over and over and over, that we would be probably on many youth trips, the kids that had your dad not been the pastor of the church, we'd have gotten sent home every trip out.
And we should have been sent
home. Should have been sent home every trip. And I'm thinking on a couple of levels here. One, I remember the first time we preached that I remember us preaching was some mission trip that we took to Wyoming.
Hannah, Wyoming.
And they decided we're going to let you guys preach. And so you preached two nights, I preached two nights. And it was a tag team tandem, and it was unbelievable. The response was phenomenal.
Yes, the first night you preached and 19 people came. The second night I preached and no one
I preached it
came.
Down to zero.
You preached. The only people there were the people that came with our group. There were five of them, and I had worked about 4 months on this sermon. But we found out later that night was the beginning of the citywide softball tournament to which everyone went. But I preach my sermon anyway, and and you don't remember this, or maybe you do. When I finished my sermon, I thought I'd been going for about an hour, and I had preached fully my entire sermon on Samson in 15 minutes.
Exactly.
And you walked up, and you said, did you know that you only preach for 15 minutes?
And well, we were used to your dad going at least 50. So I was all buckled in.
You just rushed right up.
It's
I thought you were going to tell me what a good job I did. You only preach for 15 minutes.
Oh, my goodness. And then the only thing else I remember about that is on the way home is some huge pillow fight somewhere in on the way home that turned into a fiasco that I'm sure one of the other of us was responsible for. It's terrible. But my favorite, I mean, there's so many moments, but one of my all-time favorites is Sunday night. And I don't know if I remember this all correctly or not, but we're sitting up in the balcony. No one's in the balcony. It's a Sunday night. I'd say there may be 1,500 people sitting in the downstairs, and we're in high school.
They had closed the balcony,
But we are up there nonetheless, sitting in the middle of the back of the balcony. This balcony went from both sides, coming in, you know, both sides of the platform, all the way around. It was really high in the back, big, huge balcony, big downtown First Baptist Church. You're sitting in the middle. I'm sitting on your right.
But first, the picture is we were sitting on the front row of the
balcony. Front row of the balcony.
So we're looking at, we're at the rail.
Yeah, and this rail was solid, and it was pretty high and sturdy. I mean, it was kind of a wide enough to sit on. We'd done that many times, actually walk on. We'd done that quite a bit as well. We're sitting behind this thing. This is an old church. So it's got all these contraptions up here where they used to plug in the TV lights for back in the day when we were on live TV and all this stuff. And you're in the middle. I'm on the right. There's another guy on the left.
Stanley King. I remember who was up there with us.
Oh, I love it. Oh, man, that's awesome.
And we're sitting shoulder to shoulder.
Shoulder to shoulder.
And we're the only ones up there.
Only people up there. And at some point, someone takes a Wrigley's gum wrapper.
You.
Me. And rolls it up like a cigarette or worse.
Joint.
And I'm acting like, you know, we're smoking this rolled up tin foil wrapper.
Right.
And then at some point I decide I'm going to put it out in this little box that's attached to the wall, which has, it's a square box about 4 inches square with two metal flaps that open in.
It had springs on them.
It had springs on them. Yeah. And so somehow, we don't know what they used it for, but it looked like a cool ashtray. So I stick the little aluminum tinfoil cigarette into the ashtray.
That was an outlet.
That turns out was an outlet for like a big, heavy...
A 220 outlet.
Light plug from the old days. And immediately this sound is like... And a huge plume of smoke. I'm not exaggerating. Big enough to cover the three of us.
It was big.
White plume of smoke comes up out of this thing. Well, straight ahead is your dad, and
preaching.
He is just going to town preaching, and now there's this big plume of smoke covering all of us, and it wasn't like a boom,
but it
was loud enough that everybody in the building knew something happened in the balcony, but a lot of people couldn't see up there because they were sitting too far back, but your dad is like bead right on us. Well, I go over to the right onto the pew. Just side down right on the pew below the rail. Stanley King goes over to the left, side down. You have nowhere to go because we are shoulder to shoulder. And the smoke kind of clears, and there are you sitting there.
All by myself.
All by yourself.
While the two of you roll over onto the floor and crawl out the side doors.
Crawl all the way around to the sides that are towards the platform, creep up out the doors, and we're gone. And there you're sitting, and I don't know what happened. I don't know what your dad said or if he said anything or what happened after that point.
I don't think he said anything.
I think he just thought, oh, my gosh.
I think he knew there were three, and then there was one.
And I know he knew who was responsible for it because no matter what happened, it was like, there he goes. Butch Giglio put something else in the deal. So we're back, and now you have the real story of the life of a couple of guys who, you know, were giving people fits. And I share that story, and I'm telling you, every bit of it's true. In fact, it's probably even better than we made it sound. I think it was a pretty big deal in the moment, and it was one of the classic ones. There are others we could have chosen. There was the Sunday night when the youth choir was singing, which we did often at our church, and we had a big church, I mean, in a big choir loft, and the baptistry stuck out in the choir loft. So if you were in the bass section, last row, you were split by the baptistry. But you could always look across the baptistry and see the guy on the other side over there. On this one night, Andy ended up on one side, and it was kind of like a Letterman-esque thing even before Letterman. It was how many hymnals can float in a baptistry that night. We were counting down times and taking bets, and so we would ease one in. And the hymnal will float for a long time, I'm here to tell you, a lot longer than you think. So we probably owe the music fund at First Baptist Atlanta for, I don't know, 6 or 8 hymnals that went in that night. We would count down and it would sink, and we'd go, wow, okay, how long do you think it's going to take this next one to sink? And then we'd push it in, and it just, idiots is what I'm trying to say, absolutely complete idiots. And so I share those not to aggrandize, I think that's a word, our past, and certainly not to make much of something that's really not good, or to make light of something that isn't good. But I share those in case you've got any guys or girls in your youth group, and you're looking at them going, this is what's wrong with America. Just hang in there. They could potentially be the future leaders of the church, and you never know. So next week, we're going to come back with Andy. He is going to share his favorite story from our high school and college days together, opening the next installment. And this is the last installment, so this will be the third and last installment of our interview with Pastor Stanley and Reverend Stanley and Andy. And so it'll be exciting when we come back. Hey, by the way, while we've been going in the podcast, our registration has shot up a whopping 3 people. So we've gone up from 3217 to 3220. But as you understand, 3620, from 3617 to 3620. But as you understand, Andy's interview happened already. So see, we haven't listened to the whole interview. So it really was pretty good. It was 3 people in a relatively short period of time. But anyway, we're glad you've been with us today. Hope you're enjoying this stuff. I'll tell you, when I say Andy's the best leader I know, I think you know what I'm talking about now. He just drops these nuggets like almost in conversation that you're like, I want to write that down. I want to figure that out. And I want to implement that in my whole life from this point forward. And there's a few more of those coming in the next installment. So hopefully you'll be back with us, and we look forward to seeing you then on the Passion Podcast. Take care.